Mini episode 138 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 138 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. Another tremendous segment for you here today. We're going to be revisiting something from a couple of weeks ago. We had on the show, as part of a roundtable, to preview the 2012 Stanley Cup Final, Keith Cornelia of KingsCast, and he was making his second appearance on the program. The first one had been for an NHL season preview, I believe, for the 2010-2011 season. So it was good to be able to get him back on, and again, from his unique vantage point for this Stanley Cup Final, covering for a long time the Los Angeles Kings, and as he and I both forecast in that segment, it came to pass. The Los Angeles Kings are your 2012 Stanley Cup champions. So our senior producer, the FDH New York Bureau, Steve Servillo, reached out and got it hooked up again, and we're very pleased to welcome Keith back to the program here for a little post-mortem of the Stanley Cup Final Series. And I'll look at the entire spectacle on and off the ice. It is truly unique when you have something like this happen in a media market like Los Angeles, which is not a natural one for hockey. So there's a lot of fascinating angles to this team finally reaching its destiny, as we say, on and off the ice. And we'll be breaking them all down with Keith Cornelia of KingsCast. That's KingsCast.tv. Keith, welcome back to the FDH Lounge. Pleasure to have you on the program again, my man. And congratulations, your team, a very worthy champion, brought it home.
It is great to be back on the show. Thank you very much. I'm glad to see both of our predictions sailed through.
Yeah, they did. And yet, that's where I think I want to start is by asking you about that. I said Kings in six. I think you had indicated that you thought the Kings would win, but that it wasn't going to be quick and easy like the previous couple of rounds here. And yet, I got to figure that the way it unfolded was not the way that you forecasted it would go, certainly not what I thought. A 3-0 start and then some real, real anxious moments there before that critical penalty in Game 6 ended up sealing the fate for the Devils.
You know, it's funny. I think I said Kings in five. I've been kind of going there the entire time, given the trajectory of how they played. But it was really interesting to see the media spin on it. The Kings, you know, they win the first three. And I think, you know, games one and two could have gone either way. I definitely think the Devils had a shot of getting it. And the Kings, you know, they got the bounces. The Devils didn't. And then, you know, you go into the next two, and they're like, okay, the Devils are coming back. Here we go. So, you know, the first three, the Kings are winning the Stanley Cup. Then the next two, the Devils were going to come back and win the Stanley Cup. And then going into game six, you know, a lot of the media had just predicted the Devils were going to do it and take it to seven. But, you know, what an incredible turnaround. I mean, you want to talk about a way to close out a game six that gets you to the Stanley Cup. I mean, that's definitely the one to do it. But it was really interesting watching the media spin the entire thing.
Yeah, because the trajectory of it was really I think it just threw everybody for a loop. It was something where the Kings, again, just really kind of picked up where they left off in the previous couple of rounds for the first three games there, and yet the Devils coming back subsequently. How much trouble do you think the Kings would have been in had it gone to a Game 7, having to go back to that building?
I think it would have been a pretty big momentum shift, and I didn't really – treat games four and five like it was a huge momentum shift. I thought the Kings played well. I thought that the Devils got the bounces. And, you know, that's just been the way it's been. And, you know, I know it was, you know, you kind of want to see a seven-game series. You know, everyone really does. But it wasn't necessarily slanted in anyone's favor outside of maybe, you know, games three and then, of course, game six, which was a blowout. I thought the Devils played great hockey, and, you know, it came out that, you know, Ilya Kovalchuk obviously had a back injury. You know, my sources told me it was a herniated disc, and he wasn't getting any feeling in his legs from time to time. So you take that out of the picture, and, you know, I know not all of the injury reports have come out of New Jersey, but, you know, it looked like Zach Parise might have been a step behind as well. So you're dealing with a lot of people that were banged up in that series for the New Jersey Devils. So maybe you didn't get that best showing from them. But I still thought that they played really, really well. They had a lot to hang their heads on there. And, I mean, what a guy that Henrique. I mean, you know, another game-winning goal for the New Jersey Devils. So it was definitely an interesting series, certainly one that, you know, on paper might have looked like the Los Angeles Kings had that edge. But I thought it was a lot more evenly matched watching it.
No, you're absolutely right, because, again, the bounces really were going the Devils' way in games 4 and 5. As you pointed out, sort of a mirror image of the first two games at the very least, which were very close games before the Kings blew it open in game 3. But how big do you think that that penalty was in game 6 there at the end? I mean, clearly once it happened, Kings were just firing at the net with abandon, and it was pretty clear that by the time it was even strength again that the series was done. But what's your sense? I mean, it's so hard to look at this in an alternate universe where that never happened. I mean, it seemed to me like the Kings were probably on a trajectory to have a really good night before that. But what's your sense of what might have happened absent that moment?
I feel the same way. I think that was the first game in the entire series where, you know, the Los Angeles Kings came out and they weren't looking to feel the other team out. I felt like they came to play. They came and, you know, like they wanted to win. You know, they were much more aggressive. And that was one of my criticisms of the Los Angeles Kings, you know, throughout the series, that they weren't quite physical enough. And, you know, they just, their power play obviously had been abysmal for almost the entire length of the playoffs. But, you know, not looking at that penalty, yeah, maybe it is a tighter game, but I do feel like they came to win. And the large majority of the game, I felt like they had. You know, looking at that penalty, you know, I still think that you have to make the call. Certainly people a lot more educated than I, you know, Bob McKenzie, you know, you make that call every time because of the injury. With Scuderi looking back, maybe, but, you know, I still think that the Kings had it. There were still a lot of goals that, you know, that happened in spite of that, and contributions from all around. And that's what the Kings' identity has been when they're winning, is that they're getting, you know, they're getting goals, they're getting key plays from people that aren't necessarily in your top six, you know, people willing to grind it out around the net. And that's what we saw in that game up by that penalty. So, you know, as you know, certainly sitting up at the stands there, I felt like they came to win. And, you know, we were confident. And when we got that goal and you had three, it was sort of a catharsis there.
I can very well imagine. And again, just being there had to be so incredible. And I flash back in my head. I mean, I wasn't there in person as a Wings fan when they broke through in 97, but just the countdown to it. It was kind of a foregone conclusion at that point late in the game that it was going to be the case. So what was it like for you as you're sitting there actually fortunate enough to be in the arena watching it happen? I mean, I'm sure it's got to be a lifetime of memories as a Kings fan, and probably thinking about the good times, the bad times, and I would guess it's all kind of bleeding together in your head as the seconds are ticking down, no?
No, because as a Kings fan, you know, being conditioned for mediocrity and failure, you always kind of go to that, well, you know, they could come back. And, you know, certainly
okay.
The first period, there was a lot of, you know, screaming, you know, by Kings fans, you know, we got this, you know, but 3-0, one of the worst leads in hockey, especially coming out of the first period. So we had heard a lot of chants of, you know, we want the cup. And, you know, we were kind of silent. We liked our chances definitely going into that second period. But at the same time, you know, you got 40 more minutes of hockey left to play. And you got the champions of the East that were playing. So, you know, after the second period, you start getting a little more confident. And then when we had that empty net, that's the time when we start celebrating, because, you know, we finally seen it happen. And so many great things have happened to the Kings in the playoffs. But as a Kings fan that's been around the game for a long time, you know, that's covered the team, it doesn't really become a reality until the last 3 minutes. And that's when it became real for us.
Well, while I didn't look at it that way, you raise an excellent point, because 3-0 actually happens to mirror what the series lead was. And yet you were sitting there for game 6. So, yeah, the fragility of 3-0 leads can be the case, Keith, both in a series and in a game, as we've already seen. So you raise an excellent point. I wonder also, too, you talk about, you know, psychic scars and everything that's happened over a period of time. I look at it, as do most people, that you guys are kind of the originators of the NHL's Sunbelt strategy here. A lot of people trace it back to, okay, Gretzky gets there in 88. This is when the league starts thinking, okay, we got to do that. Maybe that's a little bit of a burden to put on you guys because there's a lot of us that think that they oversaturated some of these markets. But nevertheless, you guys were the ones I think most of us think of as being the ones that were really kind of first and where the league got the idea from. And yet, one of the teams that came along as a result of that, Anaheim, gets it done in 2007. I have my own horrible memories of that thanks to Andres Lilja in the Western Conference Finals. So I can share your pain in seeing that your rivals make it. But what kind of psychic scars did that leave? That here come these guys, and they're not exactly newcomers after 16, 17 years, whatever it was. But with those guys beating you to the punch, did that make it all the more bitter as you guys were waiting for that first championship?
100%. I mean, you know, the Anaheim Ducks used to be owned by the Walt Disney Company. I mean, yes, AEG is a huge corporation. Walt Disney was sort of the personification, especially because, you know, the Mighty Ducks was a movie before, and they were just so hated. But, you know, you look at what ownership gave Brian Burke the opportunity to do, and that was to bring in players. He was very, very aggressive. I remember the year that they went to the Western Conference Finals when they lost to the Oilers, and they were at the bottom of the league, and the Kings had come out in front, and, you know, they made it, you know, they traded Korea away, and they made, you know, got Beauchemin, and you started to see this team come together. It was a very elite team, and, you know, the signing of Chris Pronk. I mean, it was horrible. When they raised the cup, I mean, I almost cried, and I did not cry when the Kings won the Stanley Cup. So, I mean, yeah, the psychic scars were definitely there. No matter what happens, Anaheim Ducks fans can always say we got there first. I've definitely left some scars, but it definitely made it a lot sweeter now knowing, you know, where what position we're in moving forward to next year and where the Ducks are, which is kind of in this weird rebuilding sort of situation. So I like where the Kings are at this point.
Well, you actually touched on a couple of different threads of what I was going to ask you about next, vis-a-vis the Ducks and the way that they built their team and the pieces that they had in place in 07, because I see that as being similar in some ways to what you guys got in place in 2012, with I think most people would agree, a better chance for these things being lasting because of the ages of some of the players and everything. So I'd like to ask you about some of the key pieces that are in place there. I guess I'll start with Drew Doughty, who, with an Olympic gold medal previous to this under his belt and having been such an instrumental player for Canada in that, I mean, if you're looking at players that are going to be, you know, leaders of the next generation here in the league, it does seem to me, I don't know if it does to you, that he has probably a chance to be that preeminent player of the next generation when you look at the fact that he's got some years on Shea Weber and on Zdeno Chara and some of the other guys yet to come here. It would seem like he's got the chance to really define the next generation the way that Lidstrom did the last.
I think he does if he wants to. And, you know, one of the knocks on Drew, and he had a rough start to the season, and he admitted it, you know, himself, that the, you know, the contract sort of had a burden for a lot of the season. And, you know, he was hurt for a little bit of time as well. But, you know, Drew has the potential to be a leader. He does have the potential to be a preeminent defenseman, but he needs to become a little more mature. And, you know, you saw it yesterday during the Kings rally. You know, if you watched online, you know, they had him come up to do a speech, and it was three words long. You know what I mean? It just seemed you could still see that 22-year-old kid who's got $7 million and an Aston Martin who, you know, for Drew, he's got all the talent in the world. If he puts in the hard work, you know, if he brings himself to that conditioning level that Dean Lombardi demands of his players, you will see that preeminent defenseman. But if he doesn't, he'll be a really good, solid player for the Kings and, you know, have some highlight reel plays. But to me, it's up to Drew if he wants to do that.
Well, maybe Lombardi could arrange for a motivational talk from Patrick Kane. Hey, you're a young guy, but keep your head on straight. Maybe he could hook that up. But when you're looking at some of the other guys there, too, and this next one might be a little bit unfair, but when you look at Anze Kopitar with the potential that he has, it would seem to me anyways that he's got the burden now, I think, of being worthy on a consistent basis of being mentioned with Ovechkin and Crosby and Malkin, and we saw this year Claude Giroux taking a step up to that level there. And again, at his young age, is that something that you see being possible, that this can be one of the defining offensive players of the next generation?
I don't necessarily know that he's going to ever score 50 goals. Although, you know, that said, the offense didn't start clicking until very late in the season. And one of the knocks on Kopitar offensively is that he has been a little bit inconsistent. And that's been true. But that said, you know, here's a guy that has the whole package. He works hard. You know, Dean Lombardi a couple of years ago called him out on his conditioning. Not that he was ever, you know, fat or sloppy, but he just didn't meet the requirements of the organization. But, you know, Kopitar has that offensive, you know, offensive flair. Definitely, he's a big body. He's so responsible defensively. I think you'll start seeing him, you know, get nominated for a few Selke awards, you know, in the next few years. Is he going to put up 50? No. But imagine, you know, if you put if Dustin Brown, who I think is now really entered his prime, next year, what the two of them can do together. You know, you might see some good numbers. I think, you know, coming into the season, you were hoping he would be a top 10 center in the league, and I think he's starting to emerge as maybe that top five. So, you know, I don't think necessarily at that Ovechkin-Malkin range, but you know, definitely up there and someone that almost everyone would want to have on their team, on their elite cup team.
Absolutely. I mean, as he proved this year, that's definitely the case. One of the more interesting guys to ask you about, I would say, would be Jonathan Quick. Just taking a look at, again, as is the case with the other guys, the common thread here, his young age. But I'm very intrigued because, particularly with him playing against Brodeur. You look at Brodeur and Waugh and Hasek and that generation of goalies, and we just really haven't seen anybody in the last decade or so step up, with the possible exception, I'd say, of Henrik Lundqvist. That would have made for a heck of a finals if it would have been him and Quick on opposite sides, and we almost saw that. But you've had a lot of guys that just haven't had the longevity to pull it off, whether it be Marty Turco or Mika Kiprusoff or even Jaguar. He didn't really have the longevity. You know, now Roberto Luongo's got his issues. He's having trouble holding on to his starting job. So, long story short, do you see Jonathan Quick as being able to kind of defy this trend and be able to live up to this potential over a long period of time, or is it just getting harder and harder for goalies to do that over an extended period of time today?
You know, I do in Jonathan Quick's Jonathan Quick's a winner. He takes his conditioning very seriously. And, you know, the knock on him, I mean, I think he was a third-round pick under Dave Taylor. And, you know, a lot of people figured he would be a decent backup goaltender or starter in the AHL, you know, maybe borderline starter. And the thing with Quick is that technically he is not necessarily the best goaltender in the league, but his athleticism is off the charts. And one of the things that we haven't seen from Jonathan Quick is an injury yet. And, you know, eventually that will happen eventually. What happens when he comes back from that injury? You know, can you continue to perform at such an athletic level as a goaltender? That's a good question. And that's part of the reason why we drafted Jonathan Bernier, who is definitely technically more sound, you know, plays the puck behind his net much better than Quick does. But, you know, if I'm Dean Lombardi and I'm sitting there and say, I got a Conn Smythe winner, a guy that doesn't, you know, hasn't shown any shades of getting tired, you got to lock him up, you know, because, you know, Bernier's kind of an unknown right now, and you have to hope that Quick can kind of hang in there. And just the attitude level I'm seeing from him is, and then the fact that he's not playing in a Vancouver or, you know, in a Toronto, and, you know, he's not constantly being spotted at the grocery store. I think all those kind of things kind of play in, and I think that's why we'll see, you know, come July 1st, I think you'll see Quick locked up long term.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, the fact that he's in a non-traditional hockey market, yeah, that might definitely play in his favor. Now, in terms of that, in terms of asking about players on the team, the next question I've got is of a non-on-the-ice nature, and that being, it was, I think I retweeted one of your tweets, Dustin Penner, when he was speaking of Bill Maher, and I was applauding what that Dustin Penner had to say anyways, because I don't like Bill Maher for reasons that have nothing to do with his disdain for hockey. So that's another matter altogether. I'm not at all a Bill Maher guy. But talk about this whole thing that, again, it's got to be a real kind of tension out there. You guys who have been on the bandwagon for a long, long, long time, there's people jumping on it now. There's people like Bill Maher who want to use this to get some attention for themselves. But look at me, I'm aggressively indifferent to it. So what's the dynamic been out there in L.A. the last couple days? I mean, it's a fascinating town, even when nothing like this is going on. But I got to believe, with the Kings winning it, that the reactions and everything you're seeing just makes it that much more fascinating.
It has, and you know, it's been largely positive. And you know what? Bill Maher's probably only upset because the Kings didn't offer some sort of suite for the game, you know. But let's face it, he's not that big of a celebrity. You know, he hasn't been on network TV in a very, very long time. So, you know, I thought it was great, first of all, Dustin Penner calling him out. I think it's been really interesting, if you look at the Kings' Twitter feed, is that a lot of the negative sentiment they kind of embrace and turn it on other people. So it's made the negative very, very funny. And some of the Kings players have a good head on their shoulders, like Dustin Penner, who's a very smart guy. Calling him out like that was hilarious. But the sentiment around Los Angeles has been very, very positive. It's been a great thing to be a part of, you know what I mean? It's as coming together as Los Angeles could possibly get for hockey, and I'm okay with that.
What are you seeing as far as the last couple of days, and I guess even the stretch run in terms of the Stanley Cup final and everything else, this only being the second time in team history and the first time since 1993, were you getting a sense that something like this is helping hockey to reach places it doesn't generally go, whether it be the urban market or other things like that? Are you getting a general sense of the broadening of the appeal to something that might be more than temporary, or does it seem to you largely kind of like, oh, okay, this is what happens when a team wins the Stanley Cup and it may just recede next year?
Well, you know, the thing with Gretzky is that he was a generational player who was also a big celebrity, so that carried a lot of, you know, credence across Los Angeles. And with the Los Angeles Kings, they won the Stanley Cup. That's a great step. You got a lot of kids that weren't necessarily familiar with the sport of hockey wearing the Kings, Kings shirt, Kings hat. But the bottom line is, you know, like your Detroit Red Wings, you know, you got to win more than once. You got to be known as a winner, you know, because if we get bounced in the playoffs or bounced in round one next year, we're sort of a blip on the radar like the Carolina Hurricanes. So if you're going to get any more, you know, community involvement or hockey reaching people like the urban environment, it's going to take a lot more than one championship. And the bottom line is hockey's a very, very expensive sport. And, you know, this isn't like an underprivileged town outside of Toronto where hockey's already big and, you know, you got people donating equipment in Los Angeles. You don't really see people going out to East L.A. wanting to build a rink and donate a lot of hockey equipment because it's just not that prevalent yet. So I think, you know, if there's some more championships for the Kings or maybe the Sharks get involved, you know, God forbid the Ducks win, that's only good for Southern California hockey. But as far as how long that continues to go, it's going to be a while. It's going to take a lot more winning and a lot more of this bandwagon stuff to happen before, you know, before it really does much.
Okay, so it could take another 20 years before we're looking at youth rinks in Compton then. Okay, so I'll clip and save that for when we get to that point.
But we'll revisit it in 20 years.
Well, as far as this team goes, it's very interesting you mentioned about Carolina, because I think there's the sense of a lot of us that follow hockey that you guys are not in that mold. The thing that kind of sprung to mind with me more so was Chicago when they won 2 years ago minus the bad contracts that they immediately had to offload, because, again, they did it with such a young core at that point in time. I mean, you guys look like you're built to keep making good runs the next couple of years. We've seen in recent history here, it's hard to repeat. It's hard sometimes even to go deep 2 years in a row. Granted, the fact that you guys didn't lose a lot of games in the playoffs, you know, that the road was not as arduous as it might have been otherwise with some of those four-game series. But nevertheless, I mean, what's your overall sense? How much optimism do you have in your head and in your heart looking at the next year or two and the continued run of this team?
I am optimistic because of the job that Dean Lombardi and Jeff Solomon have done about structuring contracts. You look at this, you know, this offseason, you have Jarrett Stoll and, you know, Dustin Penner unrestricted. So that's about $7 million there. And then the following season, it's Rob Scuderi and someone else. So cap-wise, we're in really good shape. We can re-sign quick, and we can probably make a play for, you know, someone, probably not Zach Parise, because he's going to definitely get paid Brad Richard's money. But we have the ability to reach out there, maybe make another big trade, or, you know, sign that unrestricted free agent who could come in. You know, I look at the team, and I, you know, on paper, I think we're a really, really good team. And, you know, I said to you guys last week or two is that, you know, to me, my expectations were the Western Conference Finals, because I thought we were one forward away. Now, Dustin Penner certainly turned it up in the playoffs. You know, is he going to resign in L.A.? I mean, he says he wants to. I don't think there's room for him. Simon Gagné kind of in the twilight of his career. So I still see us as needing another top six forward. I think we're set on defensemen for a while. We have enough people in the system to fill in when Scuderi's up and, you know, Willie Mitchell the year after. So I think we're definitely good in goal, defense. And I think there's a little tooling that Lombardi kind of needs to do. But the good thing is that we have people on long-term contracts at affordable cap hits where I think we can be competitive and certainly be in the conversation for another Stanley Cup for the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. So it's all about who we end up signing. And, you know, if players continue to respond to Daryl Sutter and the coaching staff. And, you know, yesterday during the rally, you know, he was called up to speak. The players gave him a standing ovation, which is huge because, you know, you don't see a lot of emotion typically from that. So I like where we are. And it will be interesting to see now that we're Cup champions, you know, are there people wanting to come to play in LA? When people ask to be traded, is Los Angeles on their list? Because it hadn't been there for a lot of years. I mean, Lombardi made plays for big plays for Eliash, Chara, you know, Drury, Kovalchuk, lost out. You know, we were plan B. So it'll be interesting to see if we're a plan A for more players now.
Well, in terms of that, and I guess that's how I'll bring it around, is to ask you on that going forward, your sense of it. Because, again, I go back to my Red Wings and the way that things went up until Nick Lidstrom's retirement here with the salary cap. They had a system in place there where Lidstrom wasn't taking the max amount and nobody else, out of respect, was asking to be paid more than that. It would seem like you guys are set up for very much the same if these guys will buy into it, if there will be a little bit of give back from some of the key players so that they can go make another acquisition or so that they can keep the thing intact and not have to break it up. What's your sense of how these core of players are going to respond when the next contract comes up, and then the one that in many cases is going to be the big one for their career on if they're willing to make any kind of a sacrifice to help keep the core intact?
Well, the good news is that we had two people that already did that, and they're all long-term contracts. However, they signed with the Philadelphia Flyers, not the Los Angeles Kings. But we have them now. You know, I think you're going to see a lot more of that. I mean, Dean's all about, you know, team, and having the, you know, the Kings logo tattooed on your butt. And I think with the exception of Drew Doughty, who held up for, you know, more money and we ended up paying him, I think you will see people like Dustin Brown, to a certain degree, Anje Kopitar, and they're up in the next, you know, couple few years, maybe take a little bit of a pay cut to do that. But we're not in Red Wings territory yet because we don't have the identity of that organization. We have one cup, you know, you guys have like 15. So, you know, it's definitely a big difference. But I do think you will start to see people willing to, you know, say, hey, I want to come play in L.A. I'll play for a few bucks less. And I think that's a great place to be. And, you know, the leadership group in Los Angeles, I mean, there's so many people on the team who are captains and former captains that don't even have a letter and have just, you know, set the precedent that, you know, they're here to play and it's all about team. So I do think you might see that moving forward. I don't think you'll see that with Zach Parise if he goes unrestricted, because quite frankly, I don't know if he wants to play, you know, in the, you know, geographic West. So, but, you know, other unrestricted free agents, I think you might start to see that, definitely.
Well, personally, I'm looking forward to seeing Parise in a winged wheel. I don't know if that'll work itself out or not, but no, you make an excellent point on the depth of leadership in a room there. I remember that like Igor Larionov never wore a letter in Detroit. So when you have guys, when there's not enough C's and A's to go around in a room, that's when you know you have a real enviable depth of leadership. And that's clearly what this team had and continues to have, you know, an excellent team, an exciting young core, and very worthy champions. And Keith, it's always fun talking hockey with you on the show, my friend. I look forward to doing it as time goes along here and as we start to get into the next season. So thank you so much for joining us once again.
It's my pleasure. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
I truly appreciate it. Thank you very much. Keith Kornilok from KingsCast.tv. We thank him for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in. FDH Lounge mini episode 138.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Paper Mate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.